Okay, so today I'm going to be talking to you about autism history and the communication of scientific findings in eras of uncertainty and controversy. How does this thing work? Does this click and go forward? Yeah, there we go. Just quick acknowledgement, the research was funded by NEHS and Autism Speaks, my collaborator Craig Neuschaper, and some other folks. I won't go through that long list. So why look at autism risk communication and ethics? Well, there are very few studies and papers examining risk communication and ethical issues associated or unique to ASD. So 2 years ago, we applied to NIHS and Autism Speaks for funding to bring together a diverse group of stakeholders to discuss these issues, to try to lay out sort of the agenda for where this research should go. And we brought together folks from the science side, from the advocacy side. We had autism self-advocates there, and also from the provider side. We had about 120 people at the meeting, and we came up with some areas of need and action areas as well that I'm going to talk to you about today. I'm also going to talk to you today about some of the historical context for what has put autism in what I think would be easy to call sort of a risk communication quagmire. And I'll talk a bit about that also. So the areas of need that we identified were autism and culturally sensitive genetic counseling, the communication of complex genetic test results and their uncertainty, communicating potential harms from autism research to parents, patients, and the public, and the communication of complex etiologies to diverse stakeholders. I should also apologize that for some reason going from a Mac to a PC, cases drop and change randomly, so my apologies if some of these slides look a little funny. And finally, understanding the autism diagnosis in an era of uncertainty and controversy. Most of you, I'm sure, if you or work in this area, or at least pick up a newspaper periodically, you're familiar with some of these controversies, which I'm going to describe in a moment. So, and this is just to show the need for this work, given the changes and increase in prevalence of ASDs. The latest numbers out from CDC are about 1 in 100. So historical controversies, I believe, in autism demand research. First, debates over autism etiology have raged for more than 60 years since the naming of the diagnosis by Leo Kanner in 1943. These debates and controversies have shaped the behavior of all stakeholders, both historically and present day. And recent debates about autism and vaccination have polarized many ASD stakeholders and have led to a deleterious impact on the public's health. So it all began with a refrigerator in the 1940s. For those of you who are familiar with this area of research, refrigerators and mothers were essentially the cause of autism. And by that, I mean that they were purely psychogenic explanations for the cause of this disorder. And cold, obsessive, distant parents were believed to cause these autistic children to turn inward into refrigerators, essentially frozen, their emotions frozen in time, and only through an act of defrosting them, literally, at least in the belief of child psychiatry from the 40s through the 70s primarily, although these ideas have lingered as late as the 90s. I gave a talk a couple weeks ago at the bioethics meetings, and a parent came up to me who was also a bioethicist and said, my kid was diagnosed in 1997, and this was the model for which I was told caused my child's illness. So this is where we began, and this is where we are today. Accusations on the other end, blaming science, particularly vaccination, for where we're at in terms of what causes the disorder. Now, of course, we know we are able to identify a few potential etiologies for the disorder, but as a spectrum disorder, still a phenotypic diagnosis, behavioral diagnosis, and still very limited understanding of what the etiology is, and there are large studies going on, including one at Drexel, which is a 10-year prospective study, enrolling women who were in pregnancy subsequent to having an already diagnosed autistic kid, and we're doing environmental and biological sampling of these women to see if we can uncover perhaps some of these complex etiologies. So the diagnosis starts with the child psychiatrist Leo Kanner in 1943, who publishes a paper in the journal Nervous Child and writes that, quote, these children have come into the world with innate inability to form the usual biologically provided effective contact with people, just as other children came into the world with innate physical or intellectual handicaps. So it starts as an inherited trait at least in Connor's mind in 43. Now, Connor was once a significant cultural and academic figure in the 1930s. He was actually the founder, in the United States at least, of the field of child psychiatry, helping to carve out a niche in the psychiatric world that gave special attention to the needs of children. Following the publication of a seminal paper, he immediately became the world expert on the diagnosis. But before the end of the 40s, he abandoned a biological explanation for the disorder for a purely psychogenic one. His new description for autism etiology laid blame squarely on bad parenting. This approach was incorporated into a 1949 paper in which he argued that the parents of autistic children lacked, quote, the warmth which their babies needed. Maternal lack of genuine warmth, Connor observed in autistic mothers, is often conspicuous in the first visit to the clinic. The children of these parents were exposed from the beginning to parental coldness, obsessiveness, and a mechanical type of attention to material needs only. And thus from Connor was born what would become one of the most destructive, reviled, and persistent theories of autism etiology, the refrigerator parent, or more commonly mother. In his view, autistic children were kept neatly in refrigerators that did not defrost. Their withdrawal seems to be an act of turning away from such a situation to seek comfort in solitude. Connor would continue to make this argument in his work through the 50s and into the 60s. Now, this shift is significant not only for its impact on the field of autism etiology, but of course for its impact on a generation of scientists involved in autism research and for the parents and children impacted by their thinking. Now, if Leo Connor was the founder of the field of autism studies and the first scientist to offer a theory of both the nature and etiology of autism, then the famed University of Chicago psychologist Bruno Bettelheim quickly became, in both scientific and popular circles, the field's chief spokesperson and researcher. From his perch as the director of the Sonia Shankman Orthogenic School at the University of Chicago, Bettelheim's work was embraced for most of his career by many in the public and academy. Most laypersons today who know about the refrigerator hypothesis lay its origins to Bettelheim, and Bettelheim's impact on the field, on autistic families, and on the popular culture should not be underestimated. For example, in 1967, the New York Times Book Review called Bettelheim's book on the subject, The Empty Fortress, a passionate, lucid account of these children who have become empty centers surrounded by an impenetrable wall of symptoms. However, Bettelheim's popular impact was at its height in the 1960s, and despite Kanner's embrace of a psychogenic theory of autism etiology, both he, Connor, and much of the growing community of autism scientists more broadly would begin to shift in the late 1950s away from the refrigerator hypothesis. In Connor, the nature of the shift back to a largely biological conception of autism is influenced particularly by the advocacy and work of parents of autistic children who rejected mother and parent blame. Connor's correspondence with two parents of autistic children, the physician Jacques May and the psychologist Bernard Rimlin, had not only a significant impact on Connor's views, but these parents, among others, helped to change the direction of both research into autism etiology and popular ideas about the refrigerator mother and parent. In 1953, Jacques May, a French physician and faculty member at New York University who would go on to become a renowned expert in disease ecology and malnutrition, wrote to Connor about his involvement in the founding of the League for Emotionally Disturbed Children, which was dedicated to the promotion of research for autism and other childhood psychiatric disorders and the improvement of treatment facilities for these children. May's hostility towards much of child psychiatry helped push him and the League to fund some of the earliest research at the University of Michigan and at several Boston area psychiatric hospitals into the possible biological cause for autism. If May and those at the League for Emotionally Disturbed Children, later named the National Organization for Mentally Ill Children and today Mental Health America, quietly led the way in seeking to shift autism etiology research away from psychogenic explanations, then in the mid-1960s, Bernard Rimlin, a parent of an autistic son and a research psychologist with the U.S. Naval Personnel Research Laboratory and author of the 1964 book Infantile Autism, would launch a popular attack against the theory. The book rejected a psychogenic theory of autism etiology in favor of a biological one. Rimlin concluded that autism was an inborn condition that accompanied children from birth. Connor, who had was befriended by Rimlin in the early 1960s, agreed to write the book's introduction, describing Rimlin's work as deserving sober scrutiny. In the introduction, Connor bemoans how autism had become a nothing but psychodynamic etiology decreed by some as the only valid explanation, so that further curiosity was stifled or even scorned. In this introduction, Connor was beginning the process of rewriting his own history, denying ownership of the refrigerator hypothesis. This attempt to rewrite his own historical record would continue until his death in 1981. Now, research into autism etiology has been conducted in three very specific historical contexts, which has made the communication of findings from studies examining the causes for autism particularly challenging. Claims about autism etiology can be divided into three historical eras. From the 40s to the 70s, claims about its etiology was rooted firmly in psychogenic theories that laid blame for the disorder on bad parenting. Beginning in the late 1950s through the 1990s, biological explanations for the disorder were ascendant as researchers rejected mother blame and relied on twin studies and family pedigree analyses to show heritability. And finally, in the present time, the causes of autism are increasingly seen in two lights. Within the scientific community, the disorder is increasingly understood as having complex causes that are both genetic and environmental, and a small but powerful group of parents and advocates believe that vaccines and vaccine preservatives are to blame for autism spectrum disorder. Now, from blaming mothers to genes to vaccines and vaccine ingredients, the search for what causes ASDs has produced more condemnation and controversy than a definitive understanding of the diagnosis. And it is this theme of blame that runs throughout the history of autism. It is a legacy left to us by Kanner and Bettelheim, but is one that has most recently appeared in the form of claims that vaccines or their preservatives are to blame for autism. Now, what is interesting about this latest appearance of blame surrounding the vaccine issue is the way in which a group of parents and other advocates have inverted what had once been mother and parent blame to blame science and scientists for the disorder. Now, given this history, the way stakeholders communicate their findings and how they communicate with patients and families has enormous implications for public health. And of course, for the children, adults, and families who are affected by this disorder. So, it's in this context that we're doing all of this research on risk communication. And one of the action areas from the conference that I want to describe briefly is this idea of balancing the communication of scientific advances and continuing uncertainty. So over the next decade, it's likely that significant research findings will be released from major autism etiology studies. Whether they're positive or negative results, these findings will be released into what I would argue is the historical context that I just described that still has tremendous cultural salience, particularly for the families who have diagnosed kids. So what we discussed was strategies for researchers and the media. Now, one of the things that we did, working with the Interactive Autism Network, was to examine among a select group of parents, science media, trust, and communication among families with ASDs. And I'm going to, how much time do I have? 2 more minutes. So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the objectives and the methods other than to say we had about approximately 300 respondents, and this is some of what we found out. So what risk factors are known to cause autism? Among this sampling, 41% said genetics, 11% vaccination, 17% environmental, 21% gene environmental, 57% said none identified. So parents generally seem to understand that we still don't know a lot in this area. What risk factors are suspected to cause autism? Again, genetics, vaccines, environment, gene environment, you know, all sort of reflecting sort of the confusion in the area, or not necessarily confusion, but what we don't know. Now, agree or strongly agree, 25% of parents do believe that vaccines cause autism. Very few believe that it's a single gene cause. About half believe that it's multiple genes. Small percentage believe that it's the environment alone. And 79% believe that it's gene environment. These results are a little bit contradictory in some ways, but this is what we uncovered. And then who are families going to for information about autism? Primarily autism providers, doctors, mental health professionals, school professionals, DAN doctors, and alternative medicine. And what was interesting, and I'm just going to show you briefly a couple of slides about the media. So the media portray autism research findings accurately. 40% were neutral, 8% strongly disagreed, 35% disagreed. So it's kind of a split group. And then reports published in the media about causes of autism have been proven and are accepted in the scientific community. You can see that most parents understand that that's not the case. So, oops, how do you go back? So just to show how this plays out in real time, a study that was released in 2009 in the journal Science identified several candidate genes in a large genome-wide association study. And the last sentence of this paper says, together with studies addressing epigenetic modifications and comprehensive analysis of environmental risk factors, these pieces of information can be better integrated to improve our understanding of the molecular basis of ASDs and to foster the development of early preventive and corrective strategies. The university, which will not be named, released a press release when the paper came out and said that the study pinpointed a gene region that may account for as many as 15% of autism cases. Nowhere in the study was this claimed, yet the press release claimed it, and then what happened, of course, all over the internet and the news, was that we found a gene that accounts for 15% of autism cases. So we have some significant challenges in communicating risk. Not only aren't we communicating risk well in science in general, but we're doing it into this risk communication quagmire that I've described in the context of the history of the disorder. So what are some of the challenges? Well, scientists, press offices, and journalists have competing goals. They convey knowledge differently. They have different career goals. Big business plays a role in this. Information spreads rapidly through both informal and formal channels. Wrapping it up. Hard to anticipate how messages are received. So what are we recommending? Scientists have to work more closely with PR offices. And you know, also PR offices have to be much more careful in how they communicate their findings, including don't overinterpret findings, especially preliminary ones. Develop standards for the communication of preliminary findings. Clearly describe the impact of findings. Get scientists media training. Get journalists scientific training. Pay special attention to online information once it's out there in the World Wide Web ether. It's there for good. And the problem of inaction, if the wrong story is printed, correct it. And the dissemination of findings is a grant-worthy piece for all of us, for all scientists of our grants, just to think about how we should disseminate what are really important findings that were discussed here today in other areas to the general public. And graduate-level training in communication and ethics was also very important. So that's it. I thank you very much. Any questions?